Go.
Welcome to Men Are Nuts, a podcast about mental health, emotional health, psychological health, physical health, awareness in men, women and society. First, it started with MAN, the acronym for Men Are Nuts. And we have a very special guest on the show for you today. This has been a long time coming. I did want to speak to you a while back, and we've been back and forth, me and Rhonda, and there's been cancellations and this and over. So, introduce yourself. Who are you? And just introduce yourself to the world.
Well, hello, world. My name is Trent Reese. I'm a guy from Niagara Falls, New York, originally.
Niagara Falls. That's
slowly I turn step by step. Yeah, at Niagara Falls.
Niagara Falls. How are you today, and what's life like for you at this moment and today, weather-wise, and where you are now?
I am extremely blessed at this moment in time that we sit and converse. I am in a place called Riverview, Florida, which is 20 miles from Tampa, Florida.
Yeah.
And the weather's about 80 degrees, and I couldn't be any more blessed.
Wow. So would you say that's mild for Florida, or pretty hot at this time of year?
I think it is. We've gone through some peaks and valleys. Not 3 weeks ago, I had a jacket on. So tell me climate change hasn't affected everything and everyone. But I think they say for this time of year, we're in the low 90s. Typically, this is my first full summer here, so I'll experience the weather roller coaster.
Yeah. Well, you spoke about climate change then, and you have some people who say, "Oh, there's no climate change," and then some people who are saying it is. I would tend to agree that the weather patterns that that seem to be existing around the world at the moment, and for the last, I'd say, probably the last year, you would say that. You could say that we're in favor of, yes, there is climate change.
Indeed. Not many people, I mean, you might not like Vice President Al Gore became hideously unpopular just because of his statement.
Yeah.
But here we are many years later. If somebody can offer me up a better explanation for the meltdown in the polar regions, the unstable weather, acid rain used to be our biggest issue.
Oh, yeah.
Now look at us. There's no normal anywhere, it seems.
Yeah, it's that's a thought as well, because people often say, when somebody comes out with something, they often say this person is a conspiracy theorist, or this conspiracy theory. But I always believe that words don't exist unless they're connected with something, and surely the words conspiracy and theory, because we have theory in science. Like you said, Al Gore came out with those things years ago, and now here we are, how many years later, and the things are happening.
Yes, I mean, significantly. I think everyone, there's natural erosion, I mean, there are things of that nature, but look at the melting in the polar regions.
Yeah.
Here you are in Florida, with snow in Texas. There are things that some people have not experienced in their lives before.
Yeah.
They have no visual experience of something. And now look.
Yeah, you're right. And there's no way that could be coincidence.
And so someone who offers up a better factual, accountability of what's happened. Okay, I'm open to it.
Yeah. And today is a significant day in terms of what's happening right now in America. What's your angle on it? What's your take on it? How's it impacted you? How have you, and I'm talking about the George Floyd thing, the verdict. How have you felt? Has it been felt in your, in Florida and with you?
It is felt with me in my heart, because I am a person who served this country to protect all. And I come from a single parent household, Alan, and my belief will eternally be everything starts at home. While that was a victory of sorts for many, when you finish cheering, clapping, and all of the other means of celebrations that I witnessed a little bit on the local networks and CNN, how many of those people, pro and con, are putting the work in to produce good young kids and people? And it starts at home.
Yeah.
Manners and respect and diplomacy, all those things start at home. Well, how did we get to this place? So while we have one victory, we have many rivers still to cross, as they say.
Yeah.
Are we going to get consistent? Does it affect us? It affects us all. You can see people going out of their way sometimes at a restaurant. Being a black man, walking into places in Florida that are predominantly white. But I always have an opportunity to put them at ease and change their perspective of a black man.
Yeah.
So it starts with each one of us. While George Floyd is gone, the family, I think, received some monetary support, and we've got broken hearts and things. Now, everybody involved, pro and con, are we willing to roll up our sleeves and really make this the United States?
Yeah,
I don't get too high and I don't get too low, because there's always, like a football game or baseball, there's always another inning, and then if things aren't right, we go to overtime.
That's a good point there. It's about the steps, but once that victory, are things going to go back to normal? And I did a podcast earlier, and somebody spoke to me, and what they were saying was, he was in New York, and he was saying that things might change the other way in terms of the police, in terms of they might be not so. It's funny because he was saying that they might not be so willing to draw the gun or commit a crime as such, you know, go overboard. That's what he was saying. He was saying that this might be a reference point for that. But funny, I've just seen an article where there's a girl. It's come, I don't know if it's on the news in America, but there's, I think it's not news here, but it's on Instagram, where there was a girl, not long after the verdict was thing, a black girl, 16-year-old, was shot by a police officer.
Yes.
After she called for the police officers to come because there was an altercation. And so you think, has the change, obviously the change isn't going to happen overnight, but you'd want to think that police or people would not want to draw the gun as quick now that thing has happened with George Floyd, if you see what I mean. What sort of changes that, what, because I felt it for him when he was speaking and talking about being a black man in America, and he said he grew up in Canada, and I'm just trying to get the sense of feeling, what's it like being not just a black man, but a black person in America.
That's almost an unfair question for me, because I have been extremely blessed. There's no situation. I come from Niagara Falls, New York. Yeah. 99% predominantly white.
Yeah.
Italian, Polish, Jewish, you name it, it was there.
Yeah.
I have no horror stories. As a kid from a single family, I was protected by people. There was a gentleman who ran a restaurant. Nabisco Shredded Wheat was a factory. One day at lunchtime, because he allowed me to play with his son, who was 4 years older than me,
yeah,
he also said if I wanted to be there and eat and have ice cream, that I had to understand what the work that supported all of that was.
Yeah.
So we had to work in the stock room. We had to do. One day, I'll be brief, The place was full of workers from the disco shredded wheat that was across the street. There wasn't a black person in there but me. I came in to go to do my task of the dishes in the storeroom with Eugene, his son. And one of the restaurant visitors decided to push me out of the way to get to his beer. This gentleman with the big cash register, he had a huge meat cleaver on one side and a billy club on the other. He reached for the meat cleaver. He slammed it on the desk and he called that man some names. And he said, "That kid is like my son, you such and such. If you ever do anything like that again, I will such and such."
Yeah.
The place went hush. He scared me. But that is the closest I ever came. It was an awakening for a kid who I was probably 10 or 11 to realize I didn't see color at that time. Yeah. I saw an adult.
Yeah.
So we are guilty of not knowing the law, and we are as guilty in America as black people and as citizens in general of not knowing our rights. We don't do any research out.
Yeah.
Know the law, know your rights. Now you may be able to speak intelligently to anyone.
Yeah.
Government official, the sanitation department guy, and law enforcement. We're not doing our due diligence in families. We're not prepared with the tools before we leave home.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's
to me.
That's something that's come to the fore as well over the last year or 2 years, is people knowing the rights there and people learning about the laws and understanding what the judicial system is like and just everything about, so they can, in fact, talk the way out of any sort of situation and know the laws. And when there's been videos, when I've seen videos where a black man or a woman has actually said the laws to the officer, they've backed off.
It changes the exchange.
Yeah.
It does.
Definitely.
It does. But Alan, let's. Here's something to jog your memory in most people, because this shows you how quickly we forget. Let's go back. Rodney King. What's old is new, but yet there's nothing new under the sun.
Yeah.
How quickly have we forgot? How far have we come as a people from Rodney King? How many years ago? Right. This is at the beginning, and this is in the infancy of telephones and recording devices.
Yeah.
I mean, really, to be used by Joe Public. What have we? How far have we come? How have we learned anything?
Yeah.
Have we united? Are we better about that? That long ago. So here we are again in the 2021 version.
Yeah, and that's again on early podcast. I actually mentioned that. I actually mentioned that the two things we've had now, we're forward, we're the most in people's, not the most intelligent, some people would say we're the most intelligent beings there ever been in the modern era. I'm not saying that we weren't the people in the past. Obviously, there's people that we know of, or how we learn through the stars, astronomy, we're very intelligent. We're saying now in the modern era, with computers and all these sort of things, like you said, the modern telephone, we've become advanced. And if you look at the two things, Rodney King and the George Floyd thing, what has changed in that time, and has anything changed? It was probably recorded more from different angles in that one, because more people had phones in that time, but the same thing. We could still see the same thing, but nothing, you can say nothing really has changed in that time. And then
the question begs, so nothing has changed? So have those involved, those directly affected, have they sought change from within to be able to be more comfortable?
Yeah.
in this United States?
Yeah.
What have we done? So here's one of the annoying things, Andy, that I hear a lot. And because there's no magic wand and nothing's ever fixed itself, if you will, you have people of all walks of life. This has got to stop.
Yeah.
Does a car stop without you pressing the brake pedal?
Yeah.
This has got to stop. Okay. Who's at the wheel? Who is going to promote the change? Who has the mental for it? Who has the leadership ability?
Yeah.
The patience and dedication for the long haul? We don't have very many Martin Luther Kings that I know of, okay, that every day you wake,
yeah,
you are willing. You know, I had some soldiers that would always want to bet. They always wanted to wager. And I really just had a disdain for anybody who says, I'll bet you. So I interjected something into the conversation. I says, are you willing to bet your life on it? No, I'm not going to bet my life on anything. I says, well, then let's not wager. So a person like Martin Luther King, every day you got up, you knew it could be your last day. Here was somebody who was willing to put his life for any cause that he had to back.
Yeah.
That's a rare ingredient.
Yeah.
It's a rare ingredient, Andy.
Yeah. And again, that was something else I picked up on as well, is where is this leader? Where is this somebody that... Where is this person or where are these people that can lead or might want to lead and, like you say, might want to put their life on the line to lead? And it doesn't look like anyone's coming forward. So let's talk about your journey and the things that you've done as a... You spoke briefly a little bit just then about your young age. You're still young now, but I'm talking about the younger age.
Yes.
Let's talk about your journey and some of the things that you've been through and your experiences.
First of all, I just got to thank God for it again. 1977, I walk up to a recruiter in my high school.
Yeah.
And I ask him if there's anything he thought I could qualify for in the Army. I was a young man without an identity. No confidence, no personality. I was a mama's boy, single parent household.
Yeah.
And he told me, he says, yes, I'm sure there's plenty, but I need to talk to you in front of your parents.
Yeah.
That day on, it changed my life. I joined the military delayed entry program right there. I went, took the ASVAB test to join.
Yeah.
And so my 12th grade year of high school counted as a year in the military. I was away from home in Niagara Falls 3 months after high school. Spent 29 years in the Army. Wonderful years. Amazing years. Worked White House support. I worked a lot of VIP and dignitary events and escorts. Simply something I did not know existed. And most of the people, including my recruiters, could not believe the journey and the things that I was exposed to.
Yeah.
Through that, the world opened up to me like it would not have if I would have stayed in my small town of 40,000
people. 40,000 people, Niagara Falls. You spoke then, just then, and you spoke about being a mommy's boy and lacking confidence. Did you say you went up to the recruiter and spoke?
I did.
As a person that was not confident, what made you do that?
I always give it to God. I cannot tell you. I had a brother who was 13 years older who went in the Navy. But then you didn't have mentors. You did not have people pouring positivity into you.
Yeah.
No one was putting their arm around me saying, hey, here's a good career path. You know, when we had career day in junior high and high school, everybody who stood on the stage who was a presenter. They never looked like me. So when that police officer, the veterinarian, the nurse, the lawyer, whoever, the firefighter, they didn't look like me. So I didn't know those were paths that I could choose.
Yeah.
You only knew the few people in your community. Well, my mother was a hairdresser. I can't say that I was wanting to be like my mom.
Yeah.
In that instance, my godfather started the only funeral home in my hometown. I very much wanted his attention and wanted to be and look like him for a long time. But he had five kids of his own and they embraced me. But those were the few examples I had. L.C. Green was the recruiter's name. He was the first black man I ever saw with green eyes. He would walk the hallways when that was allowed for recruiters to be in schools back in those days. He'd walk the hallway with his hands behind his back. He had a very gentle personality. He wasn't the rah-rah guy. And kids would make fun of him and they'd run. And it was just a lot of immaturity. That particular day, I walked in. I think I thought about it that night before. I had to have.
Yeah.
And I approached him. And the only other motivation I can tell you is my path had been chosen for me.
I was gonna kind of put some pieces together. You spoke about not being a single, coming from a single parent, your mom. And
yes.
Do you think that you were trying to find, because you even just mentioned then about your godfather, similar to me with my godfather in a sense, because I never had a male role model. And that's what I'm going with this is, do you feel that now looking back, or even at the time, that you were looking for a male role model to kind of cement what it meant to be a boy or a man or whatever? And do you think that's what led you to look up to him?
I don't know that I had the ability to separate, divide, and understand.
Yeah.
Attention, period. Attention, anybody's approval, any adult that was willing to give love and affection and or guidance, oh boy, I probably would have been a five-star athlete. I was the only black kid on the swim team. And without real practice and real, I was pretty good. I was much watched TV back then. When we would show up for a swim meet in a different school, you know, people literally said, well, we were coming to see the black kid. Track and field, I was just naturally good. You didn't have the training you have now, the nutrition and the people that focus to what, because they're looking for the next kid to recruit to your school.
Yeah.
But I wanted the admiration of people. I knew that I loved it when somebody embraced me and said, hey, you know, proud of you or good. Well, I rarely heard that.
Yeah. So basically, in a sense then, really what you're looking for, you was looking for at that age, because you said you came from a single parent. When did your parents split? Was it a long time?
Well, my dad never lived in the house. Now, my dad was there in Niagara Falls. He lived maybe two blocks away.
Yeah.
But he wasn't involved. I mean, you know, he wasn't, even when you had that visitation, I mean, it wasn't teaching me how to swing a bat, push me in a swing, you know, let's go for a ride on the bike, let's go bowling. He didn't engage like that.
Yeah.
So I actually was afraid of him. You know, I had fear of him, and I don't know why. I mean, you know, I think my dad was about 5'6" or 5'7", you know.
Yeah.
But the demeanor and how it came across. But now when he took me to the Elks, where he was a member of the Elks Club, I got more attention from some of the guys who were his friends or, you know, his associates. There were a number of characters who took the time to sit at a table and have small talk with me. And I crave that. I appreciate it. I remember it 61 years later.
Yeah. So would you say then, I mean, you're saying that he's looking for you're looking for attention and love and somebody to to maybe, you know, give you, to kind of put you on a path. And would you say then that this man in this school was almost this person that you looked up to, in both as a child, as looking up to an adult? Would you say that there was somebody that you look up to?
I was good at eavesdropping on adult conversation, which could cause you to get a good whooping. Yeah. When I came up.
Yeah.
And so by listening to adults, I had determined my brother had been in the Navy. But not only did I not like the uniform, but I had heard some of the things he said.
Yeah.
And there was a Marine that was in the school as well. And by listening, and then commercials on television, I had decided that this guy's demeanor on top of the uniform, but he made the difference. His demeanor. He wasn't that rah-rah, muscle-bound guy that was going to tell you that the Army was the best thing since sliced bread. His salesmanship just wasn't there in that capacity.
Yeah.
He was just, the stars aligned. And I've seen him on a consistent basis. The Army had some of the best marketing campaigns, the Be All You Can Be commercials.
Yeah.
And I was just swayed by those ingredients.
Yeah.
But he was the key. He was approachable.
Yeah.
And he always spoke to me.
That's what I was going to say. That's where I was going with this, because I was going to say, did you get an opportunity to speak with him? Because I was actually thinking that you must have spoken to him on a regular basis prior to this.
I did.
Yeah.
I did. Sergeant Davis. His name was Sergeant Davis. So, L.C. Davis. I never forget.
So,
and
so
I mean,
you warmed
for
to
months.
Him, you both warmed to each other. And you warmed to him,
yes.
Knowing that this was a man that was actually somebody that you could probably go and talk to, and he would look out for you. Probably a trusting thing.
Yes. Yes, because when he spoke to me for months prior, he never talked about the Army.
Yeah.
He just spoke, how you doing? He asked me about sports, or he could be talking to some other folks, and I'd kind of wait, you know, just to get some of his attention. So I was a kid star for attention.
Yeah.
From a male.
What I was saying, a male role model. You were looking for,
yes.
You were looking, that's why I'm going with it, because I'm thinking, because the things you said then is for me, because I know, because I brought up in a household where there was two brothers, two sisters, and were just brought up by my mum from the age of 6 or 7. And then,
yes.
I know that,
yeah.
I've missed out on, I know in my life, even now, up until this point, I'm now going to be 50 years old, and I know that I've missed out in, I say missed out, but yeah, missed out on the things that I know a male role model would have. I didn't have that. I didn't have somebody to turn to or go into the forces, the armed forces or the police or anything like that. I missed out on having a male role model. So I can see where, when you're saying those things, I get it now. He's looking for somebody to not, you know, your dad, you know, you probably didn't say much to him, or you know, like you say, his body language or the things that he said. And then here you have somebody who's complete, almost like the opposite, probably in stature and the way he speaks, and just talking, being able to talk into you, and you're looking for attention, which you're probably obviously looking for a male role model. You got the confidence to then speak to him about, you know, it's almost like you didn't you wasn't speaking about the Army and stuff before, but all of a sudden now he's got your attention, and now you want to speak to him. What was that kind of conversation like?
It was pretty brief, you know. There were some days leading up to it, where probably some months, where I asked about what types of things you could do.
Yeah.
In the military.
Yeah.
Because again, from an information standpoint, nowhere near like it is today.
Yeah.
So if you didn't look at a pamphlet or brochure, everything you got was word of mouth.
Yeah.
Now, all of the Vietnam veterans who were around town, who most of them were winos or something, well, they cursed the military.
Yeah.
You can't trust them. You don't want to go in. You'll sign up for one job and they'll put you somewhere else. And so that's where having male guidance and maturity would have been helpful to,
yeah,
cut through the confusion.
Yeah.
But again, God was looking out for me.
Yeah.
And he sent a person who was the vessel to get me through.
Yeah.
And he was the right person at the right time. It was a reason. Yeah. I didn't see the Marines in there as much. And I loved them. I mean, I would have went into Marines just for the uniform. And that would have been the worst mistake of my life.
Yeah.
You know? Yeah, he was approachable. His demeanor was such that I didn't have to work hard to be comfortable to speak to him.
Yeah. I'm trying to remember the dates now. Was this at the time where you know when the people were saying that not trusting of the military and things like that? Was this at around the time of, was this after, it must have been after the Vietnam. Vietnam would have been earlier.
Vietnam was earlier, but so you still had it, because this was 1977.
Yeah, so lack of trust there.
Right. Yeah. And, you know, look at the systemic things that have been going on. Look at the racial things that have happened. 68 riots. I mean, those pains and those wounds are eternal for many people.
Yeah.
So it wasn't that long after a lot of social things and you know, military posturing and around the world, that there were a lot of sour grapes.
Yeah. And so you're joining. What was it like to kind of get into the military? And was it, how did it feel to you to actually join at that young age?
You're scared to death, because again, that's the mama's boy. You're comfortable, everything works, there's always something in the refrigerator. Now I'm going into structure, I'm going into an environment. The one thing my mother and father did do together is that day they took me to the bus station. And they put me on that bus, and I was off to Fort Dix, New Jersey. And I got to the reception station on a Friday. And they put you in this reception station, and I thought this is great. Got my own little room, a bunch of folks in a room, and ice cream truck comes around in the morning and afternoon. You go eat here. Oh, this is how it's going to be. It's going to be great. Well, Monday morning at 5 a.m., when those drill sergeants came in with pots and pans, and I had no idea what in the world was going on. And that was the beginning of the rest of my life.
So I bet that was a shock to the system.
It certainly was. and that's what it was designed to be. They put you on a cattle truck, you know, and they took you, they rode you all around the facility. You thought you were miles away from, but that was a strategic thing, so that mentally you felt like, well, if I decide to run, I'm too far away from anything to get anywhere.
So you're afraid, or you're at that moment in time. It's almost like what the hell's happened here? Are you? Was there any point in that maybe week or 2 weeks or 3 weeks where you thought to yourself, you know what, this isn't for me. I'm going to get out.
Yes. Oh, big time.
Yeah.
And then, I mean, had some drill sergeants that were real human beings. I don't know how I would have fared in today's climate, with all of the unrest and mistrust between cultures and things. I mean, I just had good people. I had some drill sergeants who put their arm around me, talked to me, and it wasn't a con. They typically liked my personality. I did have that. I had the respect that my mother taught me. You know, shake a hand, be honest, yes sir, no sir. You know, that particular, always be clean and neat and in order. If she taught us nothing else in that little ghetto apartment, that's, you do that if you do nothing else. She says soap and water is never going to be that expensive. And those basic principles, I got a lot of mileage out of that.
Yeah. And let's go back to that there, where you, because you spoke about that kind of period where you was at, you know, with your mum, How, what was that like? You got the respect for your mum, but what was that like for you growing up? And did that, do you feel that, that even though you say you're a mummy's boy in a sense, do you feel that that had a part that that's kind of helped you in your grounding for the for the military part of your life?
It did. My mother was my original drill sergeant.
Yeah.
Clean the floors on Saturdays when I wanted to watch Get Smart and all the good programs that come on Saturday. You had to, even though the linoleum in my room, which was probably 7 feet by 5 feet, with one bunk bed in it, every Saturday you had to sweep and clean underneath that bed, and I had to put that spick and span on that one piece of tile that existed. And then the clear floor wax had to be put down a certain way. The soap in the bathroom had to. She definitely gave me her work ethic. My mother is currently 91 years old, still works two jobs and driving. She's been a hairdresser since 1956, and from 9 a.m. to 9 p.m., 6 days a week, she was in the front of that apartment in that little sunroom that the landlord allowed her to use as her beauty salon. So she was teleworking before it was invented.
So she was almost like a grounding for you then. She was a grounding for you for now to what took you to the military. Did you ever, I'm sure you're going to say yes, did, at any point, did you ever hear her words echo? Did you ever hear her words echo when you, anything, your job you might have done in the military, whether it was, I think the military, they get you to clean your boots and you know, and the bed. Did you ever hear her words echoing in the background?
Every day. Then and now. Every day. There's something that happens. And again, there's nothing new under the sun. So some principles and old adages that you get from it is simply amazing.
So let's talk about some of the things that happened in the military. I mean, obviously you don't want to go into thingy, but some of the things that, because we're talking about mental health and how did you cope after that initial spell? What, you know, for the next how many years, what are some of the things that you've been through, and what are some of the things that helped you to cope with being there? Let's give the first thing that may have happened, which was, I don't know, traumatic or something that, because I remember I've spoken to say police officers, and when I speak to police officers, they often associate the first time of doing something, seeing something, someone, you know, something traumatic, someone's fell over and died or whatever it may be, and that first time it hits them. But it's almost a bit like they become numb to it. What sort of things, some of the things that you've come across that you thought, oh, is this what it's about? Is this what the army's been about? And, you know, what are some of the things that you've come across?
First thing, 1978. We're at the firing range. And a kid who was noticeably unstable, he gets up from the prone position and starts shooting. And I get hit in the leg. Scared to death. I'm in the hospital, Fort Dix, New Jersey. Scared to death. All I want to do is go home. Drill sergeants are talking to me. I'm in there. I call my dad, for whatever reason I called him. And I'm crying on the phone. I'm in the hospital there at Fort Dix. And he has zero compassion. Nothing in his voice, nothing comes across as, son, I'll be right there, or just some words to console me. Moving from there, and I did manage to stay, you know, one of the drill sergeant Ramey came up every day. He said, listen, he says, you're a platoon guide and you're this and you're that, because we liked your personality from day one, you know, and he revealed some things that he shouldn't tell me. And he showed me some notebooks of his that they kept, that they didn't share. That made the difference. Once again, there was that person who stepped in, who showed me some compassion. And that was my bridge out of the darkness, back into light. I moved on from there. Nothing happened, I think, until, 9/11, being at the Pentagon. That was, I'm at a loss for words sometimes. I try to explain it in a way that's different each time, but that rips at your soul. It shatters everything about you that may say security or trained to handle or prepared for. There was none of the above that you could apply to that situation.
And before we kind of go into that, because I'm interested to know, and I'm sure the listeners are interested to know about that, because it's the first time I'm speaking to someone who's actually visual there and kind of is able to talk about it. When you said you reached out for your dad, that was, you said 77 you went in, so almost it was a year later, basically. 78, did you say?
78, I actually joined. I did the delayed entry program, so my 12th grade year of high school counted towards my years in service.
And so when you got shot, it was within that same year?
It was in 78. So August, September, 78.
So 78, and then you reached out. So basically, it's almost again, I'm going to say this as a man, as a boy, young boy, you're reaching out for somebody to, and the person that you're turning to is somebody, because at those young ages, as boys, we can't, I don't know, what's the word, maybe not reciprocate, as I say, we can't acknowledge that we need a role model. In a sense, we do. Because I know that working with children, and me myself as a thingy, I know that at 16 or 17 or 18 or whatever it is, 15, whatever it is, looking back even now, I think, oh, I would have liked somebody to take me to, take me to sports. I used to do it all by myself. And so having a man there, or somebody who I could see as a father figure, would help me. So basically what you then did was automatically, you've actually thought, I'm going to ring my dad, because you're actually reaching out to him, and then he lets you down again.
Because ironically, as close as I was to my mother, I don't remember if I called her during that period. I don't think I did it initially.
Yeah.
Because I didn't want to upset her. I had that.
Yeah, that's the thing.
And my mother, as much as I loved her, my mother wasn't the huggy, feely, sit on her lap, this is my baby. She wasn't that kind of mother.
And again, we got similarities there, because obviously with my family, there was five of us, and I didn't realize, and funny if I say this, and you know, maybe a clingy, but it wasn't until I was 25, maybe 26, 27, when she threw a surprise graduation party thing for me, that I didn't realize that. I knew that she loved me, but because she hasn't got that.
Didn't show.
Yeah, she didn't show it to me, because in one respect, she's you know, I'm not saying that she's, because she's Jamaican and she has to be strong, but she has to be strong for all of us, so she cannot show that love in terms of putting it on the knee and all that. She has to be tough for all of us, and I can kind of feel that with you, that there's your mum was tough, and it's when you're wanting to call her, you don't want to call her because you don't want to upset her. So the person that wouldn't really get upset, but would be more kind of masculine in a sense with it is the father.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that one time when you're reaching out for that life preserver.
Yeah.
In that capacity, and the one time I had the ability to know the difference of the two.
Yeah. And when getting through, you know, the shot in the leg, how did you cope with? Did you get a lot of help there to kind of cope, to get through that? From anybody? Were you on your own?
No. Being at the, I don't want to call it the VA hospital, let's just say the base hospital.
Yeah.
I remember one guy, he was either a veteran or somebody, he was a little older. And he was in a wheelchair due to his injury, and he would come in my room, which was a big bay. And I remember him a couple times saying, you know, basically, you don't look like you're hurt enough. You need to hurry up and get out of here and give that bed up to somebody who really needs it. Mm-hmm. You know, you got to toughen up, something of that, to that degree. I don't remember any of the staff being particularly caring or uncaring. I don't remember that aspect of it. It was so traumatic that just the fact of the incident itself and what happened, and it was a different world then. There weren't CID wasn't in there to take a report and find out what happened. I don't remember any investigations. None of that happened.
Yeah.
It was one of those things, you know, hey, if we can keep it, you know, I guess, I mean, I look back now, oh my goodness, hey, can we keep this under, let's get moving forward, these things happen, etc.
Yeah. And so what made you then want to stay there? What is it that made you want to stay within in the military?
I remember that particular drill sergeant, Ramey, who came up and talked about the reason why they always, what I thought was picking on me, they were using me as an example.
Yeah.
And they talked about me wearing my uniform correctly and how good I gave instructions in front of the platoon. And he showed me notes in this. I remember him always having a little notebook that he kept with him. He didn't just show up at the hospital with it. He always had it. I remember that from day one. And he showed me notes where they had taken notes on all of the people in my company. And what their notes said about that particular's potential to be a good soldier, so on and so forth. And he says, I'm going to share something with you. When he did that, and the fact that he showed up, and he came by one Saturday with his family.
Yeah.
He stopped by in his civilian clothes. And I just never forget that.
Yeah.
It made the difference. He was the bridge from the dark to the light.
Again, what you say, I think what you say, yeah, what you say, not what I'm thinking, I know what you're saying there, is that you, when you're saying, pointing out things like you remembered that he turned up in, you know, civilian clothes with his family, it meant a lot to you. It meant a lot to you at the time, and it means a lot to you now that he was able to be attentive to you and reach out to you. And that meant a lot to you. If we talk about the, you said, you know, join, what was, did you go anywhere? Did you go around the world before the 2011? What happened in those years?
Yes, I was fortunate. The units that I was attached to, we did very unique things. The United States Army Band, Pershing Zone, the Old Guard, which is the oldest infantry unit in history of any branch of service. I mean, working in the Military District of Washington, you've got one Pentagon, you've got one everything in D.C.
Yeah.
And I did not know it at the time. I thought that every soldier, everybody in the Army had the same opportunities I did. I didn't know how unique it was to walk the halls of the Pentagon or be at the National War College at Fort McNair, where where bird colonels go basically to college to become generals.
Yeah.
Had no idea how big the stage was that I was on. Being assigned to the Inter-American Defense College, where foreign officers and U.S. I mean, just everything in the Washington, D.C. metro area tied to the military. Yes, going overseas to Germany, going overseas to other countries, representing the military. I was with recruiting command on an exhibit team early on. We toured the country 11 months out of the year promoting the Army.
Wow.
Just a job like no other. So we would, I had a track and trailer that opened up into a 30-seat basically movie theater. And we put on a slideshow presentation. I had four projectors I'd have to sit up and break down and do. And we go to events like the Daytona 500, different big events around the United States to set this tractor and trailer up.
Yeah.
It was air conditioned and people could come in and we promoted the Army. I didn't have to be a recruiter to put people in.
Yeah.
But let's say that was marketing 101. Jobs like that, I had no idea existed when I went in. My recruiter didn't talk to me about anything. Anything that I was doing my first 10 years.
Yeah.
When I went back home and stopped by the recruiting station, they were in disbelief at the opportunities and the particular assignments that I had been privy to.
Yeah. Do you think then, had you been told that, do you think it would have changed? I'm kind of looking, like you say, it's almost like this perfect storm, as I say, because I'm thinking to myself, well, obviously we don't know, but do you think if they'd told you these things, it would have changed the course of things? You see what I mean?
Yes, because Andy, the stage would have been too big.
Yes, that's what I'm saying.
And then I would have been aware of how big the moment was, how unique it was to be at the Pentagon, how many soldiers that serve a 20-year career in the military, they never see the Secretary of Defense in person.
Yeah.
They never see the Secretary of the Army in person. They don't walk in the Joint Chiefs of Staff office to be assignments. They don't get to the War College.
Yeah.
They're not at the Tomb of the Unknown Soldier. They're not doing burials in Arlington National Cemetery. When I look back now, not until I got out of the military, honestly, and had to do a resume, and when I saw my life on paper, I am not exaggerating. I said, there's no way in the world this is me.
Yeah.
Not this kid, this little nappy-head kid from Niagara. There's no way.
Yeah.
You know, and I had to look at it time and time again, Andy.
Yeah.
And it humbles me.
Yeah.
The people I came across, the lives you touch, change, the ones you help, and the great people. And during all of this, on the military side, I started two businesses. I had a DJ business in the area. I was playing music in all of the military clubs. And all over the United States, people would hire me. I was as far as South Carolina and Texas, playing wedding receptions and family reunions. The spinoffs from that particular platform, it was an example, an early example before the term was the phrase was common. You can do anything.
Yeah.
You can branch out in many avenues and ways.
Yeah. And you know, what I'm getting from this as well is that here, you know, it's almost like, because I'm always kind of going back to that part where you said, here's this child that wasn't very confident and maybe a bit shy and reserved. And in a lot of respects, you still were, even throughout all the years, but you've just gained more confidence. And somebody has helped you to gain more confidence. And if a person had been confident and been egotistical, you probably wouldn't have had those chances.
No doubt. No doubt, Andy. And again, it comes back to my mother.
Yeah.
you know, before I understood it, even though she was pronouncing it wrong, she would always tell me as she dragged me to Sunday school and church, always stay humble. She was meaning humble.
Humble, yeah.
But in her way of saying it, you gotta be humble. You gotta be humble. Always be. And what she was dealing with in the 60s, I mean, I didn't realize till my father passed away that he was, I don't know, 18 years older than she, or something like that.
Yeah.
And my mother was a product of her environment. When I used to be shipped off to Chatham, Virginia, where she was from, where we had no bathroom and I had to dig outhouse holes and I learned how to pick tobacco and do that. Well, when I showed up for that once a year, 3 weeks with my grandmother, and I walked in that house, well, my grandmother didn't hug me either.
Yeah.
Hey boy, how you doing? The rest of them chaps is outside. You going out there with them? So the proverbial apple not falling far from the tree. My mother could only give as much as she was given.
Yeah.
Like most of us.
Yeah.
Some of us are lucky. And we find out, like I did, that God had put everything in me that I was seeking from others. So it was up to me to make change.
Yeah. And let's talk about September 11th. And where were you at the time? You know, what's your, you know, your thoughts on it, and what we know what happened, but for you, in your eyes, what actually happened?
That was my first day off in a long time.
Yeah.
I was scheduled to be at the Pentagon at 10 o'clock because in that year, 2001, the Pentagon was the only ID section. The Army was changing over the ID card, and they were putting the information chips in the card. Well, the only ID spots you could go to was the Pentagon ID section for that service because it was so new. You had other bases nearby, Navy Yard, Fort Myer, Fort McNair, Andrews, Bowling Air Force Base. This is the facility that I was scheduled to go to at 10 o'clock. Anyone who knows the Military District of Washington, Washington, D.C., Maryland, and Virginia area, it was congested even then.
Yeah.
I set my clock. I woke up. In D.C., the first thing you do before you go to the bathroom is you turn on a station called WTOP. It tells you weather and traffic every 8 minutes. And that is what you have to do to survive. I turn the TV on, I go to the restroom, I come back. At this particular time, I'm carrying two cell phones. I've got a hot phone and I've got my personal.
Yeah.
Hot phone being something connected to the military.
Yeah.
So, I was a Matt Lauer fan. He was one of the major news networks. Turn the TV on, and in the right corner of his live feed, it was showing the small aircraft in the tower. Immediately, as I live and breathe, I knew that this was a terrorist type of scenario. Not since 1941 or 42 have you had any kind of aircraft hit a building anywhere near New York City.
Yeah.
It just didn't happen. Doesn't mean it couldn't, but it didn't. But that was what was in my soul. I got a phone call from a then girlfriend, and I said, listen, be prepared to get out of the building. We had a discussion again, a reminder. I was a guy, once I got there, I don't believe in having less than a half a tank of gas in your car when you live in a metro, you know, heavily populated metropolitan area. Because at any moment, so it came to bear.
Yeah.
And so watching that second aircraft hit, I had already gotten dressed and I was already on my way towards Fort Myer. Well, once I got towards the 14th Street Bridge and you couldn't go so far, I started walking. The irony of this is, I'm going to get the date wrong, but back in 1983, I had just come off the road with recruiting command, I believe.
Yeah.
I was on my way home, and halfway across that same 14th Street Bridge, the Air Florida crash happened behind me.
Yeah.
I got out of my 76 Grand Prix in my military fatigues, and I started running back to the crash site.
Yeah.
I missed this as you talked to me earlier about things that just, because this wasn't really military related, but yet it happened.
Yeah.
So the kid getting up on the gun range shooting is one thing. My next experience that took me places is as I'm running back past the cars to get down in between the two bridges, the North and South bridges on 95, right there on the other side of the Pentagon. I'm running past vehicles that as the airplane crashed and missed the bridge, the landing gear crushed automobiles and decapitated people. And I'm running by those in the snow, slipping and sliding,
yeah,
and looking, but yet trying to get. That stays with you as well. Absolute chaos.
Yeah.
And then seeing human carnage and life lost. And thanks to my godfather and working at the funeral home, it wasn't foreign to me to see the human body,
yeah,
in states, but still graphic in nature as you drive your car down a U.S. highway.
Yeah.
And if I was 5 minutes later, that could be my vehicle.
How did that impact you in terms of, yes, you've had, like you say, seen a, you know, dead body because of funeral home and things like that, but how did seeing so many, you know, one stage, how did that impact your health and your mental health?
It impacts you emotionally because I had a big heart. I have compassion for human beings.
Yeah.
Even before I knew how to phrase it, I knew that I was going to be the change agent. I was the one who started hugging my mother and brother. Everything I wasn't getting from the people that I was seeking, once I realized God had put it in me,
yeah,
I started to be the change agent. It hurt. It. You can't change it. You can't make a difference.
Yeah.
So you're taught to preserve life as a soldier. So I'm running to get down to see if I can help those folks in the water, because here's that kid who was on the swim team who thinks he's an excellent swimmer.
Yeah, yeah.
Even in frigid water, etc. And this is before they had a title called PTSD.
Yeah.
These are things that are happening. Emotions, you know, I used to hear about adults going to see a psychiatrist. Well, that blanket title is the same thing that made people not seek counseling and to talk to someone and so on, because that was a death sentence to go see a psychiatrist. When I was a kid, you heard about, you know, people doing that. Well, you know, he's crazy or she's crazy.
Yeah, yeah. The stigma,
it just did, you know, and how do you put that on your evaluation at the job, no matter what your job was? It affected me because it was a loss of life, and I love life so much.
Yeah.
And it's a human being who had someone waiting on them, even if it was a single person that only had a pet.
Yeah.
And it affects me greatly, which is why I go through the world now. Every day I can make a difference, and you can share a hug, you can give somebody something positive, it's an opportunity every day to change the world in your small way. And so it hurt. It still hurts when I recall it, when I see it. It's like smelling death. You get that scent when you go to do an autopsy. They have a cream called mint cream. Yeah. You put under your nose. If you're entering a room where there's decomposition in a body, you get that. It's a human being that's lifeless. Someone that spoke and had character and had a smile and had emotions. It stays with you for life.
Yeah, and what's interesting about that is that even though the military might prepare you for these things, and it might be like say for the police, for instance, go back to the police where they say that they have to go and speak to somebody's mum and say, or someone's parents and say, well, such and such has died tonight or whatever, and that's the trauma. It's probably one body. You would have seen not just one body, many, and all in one go, and that must have had a massive impact on you in terms of, you know, this is not just one person, there's several bodies all over the place. Do you feel that that first incident prepared you for the 9/11?
No. There's.
Or was it just a different? This is a different level.
It is. It is. First of all, I had a little bit more maturity. 9/11. There's a big gap between the incidents. I've evolved into a more compassionate person. I grew like a garden from good soil.
Yeah.
Better soil, you get a better crop. I had taken on more feeling,
yeah,
more compassion. I understood leadership, I understood managing. No, yeah, there's one, because that was a personal thing. And I was the kid who had never been cared about. So I didn't think anybody really cared. When I look at the scar now on the left leg, you know, somebody have to ask me about it. It's not something I talk about.
Yeah, yeah. And how, in a sense, then, 9/11, how's 9/11 affected you long-term, or seeing that thing? What, you know, have you got counseling for it, or did you just ride for it?
I gave thanks to God that I was able to make a difference in a small way. I thank God that I was, instead of people at home clutching a loved one or an animal or a pillow with a box of Kleenex in disbelief, rocking back and forth or writhing in pain or waiting to see if the phone was going to ring. You know, it's a funny thing on 9/11. I don't think I got calls from people who were immediate family, who I would expect to get calls from,
yeah,
to see if I was okay.
Yeah.
But that's the story of my life.
Yeah.
That's the story. There have been strangers who have shown me more compassion and care. There's someone that you met along the way at a car wash, here and there during your journey, that was thoughtful enough. I remember getting a couple calls from people that out of DC that I had just met, you know, casually or something, but they knew where I worked and the area I worked in. So, yeah.
And your journey after that, I mean, we know the impact of 9/11, and I remember seeing it even from this, you know, from not from here, but when I was in England, from this distance, and the world was watching it in disbelief, and for you to be there, I mean, that must have been even more disbelief to be there. What after 9/11 and during that time of leading up to the kind of aftermath, what things helped you to cope with it? What things did you know, with, you said people rang, but later on, what helped you to cope?
Duty, honor, country.
Yeah.
Is cliche as that may be, when you belong to the greatest military in the world, it wasn't so much exacting revenge. It was the fact that I couldn't just ball up in the fetal position somewhere in some rural town and hide from the realities of this world.
Yeah.
The next year, or shortly after that, when plans went into place, I suited up. I got on that C-17 with the rest of my brothers and sisters in arms. Left Andrews Air Force Base, landed in Kandahar, and did what we raised our right hand up to do. That's support this United States of America.
Yeah. At any point,
and so,
at any point, I was going to ask you, just as far as I cut you then, but was there any point where you felt anger? Or because I know you said compassion, I think, but was there any point of view that felt angry that why is this happening? Why has this happened to us? Or why is this, was there any anger there or any hurt?
Yeah, there was, there's anger that civilians, people not in uniform, were targeted. Mm. I'm a target because I raised my hand. And the ID card says in my hand, and the dog tags around my neck say, I'm all in. I volunteered to be all in.
Yeah.
And I volunteered to risk life and limb. But the civilians, unarmed, going about their way in a country that we say we are free, that was the anger. You know, you pick on the scrawny kid in the lunchroom, but the guy that's your size and would be a better gladiator, if you will, you don't go that way. You search out a soft target. That was my anger.
Yeah. Yeah. And so you went off and supported, you say, the brothers in arms. How's... And again, was that, was that a revenge mission? Was it just, what, how did that feel like to you? Was it a revenge mission? Was it a thing of, you know what, I've got a job to do? You know, we spoke about anger then. Did that transfer itself into that next stage of going off and helping?
Indeed. That's what we're trained to do. You can't. There are many people who aren't good under fire, under pressure.
Yeah.
That's the best way to meet a good friend to me. Everybody's great on a weekend out on the golf course. But how's that person handle adversity?
Yeah.
Or challenge? You know, the old Mike Tyson statement? You know, everybody's got a plan until you get punched in the mouth.
Yeah. Yeah.
How well do you execute your plan then? And that's what training is. That even conveys to today's law enforcement statutes and things and rules. I mean, train people. If you truly resort to training, that means you embraced it, you paid attention, you took it serious. When it is time to put a mission in drive, Everybody knows their part. So it was time for me to do my part in support of that campaign. And I did it three years in a row, 2002, 2003, and 2004.
And since then, I mean, I'm aware of the time, and we can maybe talk about some things, you know, in another episode.
Yes.
Since that, you went out, and you know, three times. Since then, since coming out or retiring or however it happened, in fact, let me go back to those three things. You said you were angry. Collectively, or whoever, you know, there would have been a sense of revenge and anger there. Do you feel that, because some people would say when they're angry that I'm going to go for revenge, and then they take the revenge, and it's almost like, oh, well, what was that for? Or they didn't feel any better for it. How did it impact you? How did it make you feel? On a personal level, not collectively, but how do you feel personally that... Do you understand what I mean? Some people would say, oh, well, you know, I'm going to go on revenge, but then you take, you know, you go there, you take revenge, and then it's like, oh, was it worth it?
Right. Oh, it's just like the George Floyd verdict yesterday, as we spoke, initially. It's okay. The shame of that is that there even had to be a question on whether he was guilty or not, and that people have so much mistrust in the system that they actually expected that it could go another way, because that's so common. When that happened, you identify a problem, you select a solution, and you apply it. With every solution has to be a great deal of diplomacy. It has to be. No matter how, because angry will get you killed. Because you will not operate with all of your faculties in place as you address the situation and or the people involved in it. Once the cause was found, and you look at a country where this is what folks do for a living, trained to kill, maim, dismember, that's what they do. That's what they believe in. How do I go? So it gave me an even quadruple passion for love, life, and liberty. So the things I went to do, how do we heal abroad? And then back home, how do we prepare and embrace and protect what we hold dear? And that's what I did. I'm not bitter. I'm not one of those people who regret being out of the military. You give 150%, and I guarantee you, you won't miss it. You'll smile when it's mentioned, and you know that you got all of the juice out of the orange.
And you... How did you get out of the military? Was it time for you to go, or did you just, as I say, in football, did you hang up your boots?
I got hurt in 2005, over there and my knee. And between that and I think on the second mission when I flew back, they had our families at Andrews. And that was the first time my mother had ever been, I've arrived back from a campaign or somewhere in a combat zone, I'd never seen my mother, fresh off the plane. And I saw the stress. I think that might have been the first time my mother ever hugged me after not seeing me in a while. But there was a culmination of things. And when your body is broken, or you have a weakness, it's like a wounded animal in the wild. We all know how that turns out. So it was time. And I wanted to go to phase two, which was becoming, getting out of the military and then becoming a civilian and helping veterans.
Yeah.
So I retired and I took a year off, and then I went into the Department of Veteran Affairs as an analyst helping veterans as they file for their disability claims.
Fantastic. And have you ever struggled with, or had, first of all, we'll say had it because nightmares can be PTSD, or do you see that, or have you ever suffered with, struggled with nightmares or anything like that?
Didn't have the nightmares. I had the very shaky, the car backfires.
Yeah.
You want to jump and reach for your weapon kind of thing. I very, very suspicious of my surroundings. Even to this day, I'm just super aware. I can't help it. I need to know if I'm in a strange place, I need to know all the exits and entrances. but I've been let down more by personal things than I have the military affected me.
Yeah.
Negatively.
Yeah, I was going to say that. And I'm going to ask you this, before we round things up.
Mm-hmm.
Do you feel that there's some unanswered, have you ever had answers or they've not been answered from, because I feel that there's something to do with your dad there. Do you feel that there's a lot of unanswered questions, or did he answer questions before he passed?
He did not. My mother came to visit me after my daughter was born in 88. She said, your dad's looking for you or wants to see you something. And on the next day I left, I got to Buffalo, New York. He was in intensive care. I walked in and I saw my name up on the screen. That was an out-of-body experience, and he was laying there and they were trying to draw blood. I spent my life, because my father did not know how to communicate, didn't share, just didn't have the ability. I had a lot of questions for him,
Yeah. Which
is why I motivate people now to not wait till people are in the cemetery. You can go to the gravesite and you can talk, but you very seldom get the answers that one needs prior to. A lot of questions God answered for me in different ways by the people he put in my life at the right time that allowed me to keep my sanity. Let me know that so many of us think we're alone and nobody else has gone through any tragedy and woe is me, and you got the violin going. And boy, as soon as you talk to real people that have lived real life, it's really, really uplifting and can allow you to get steady again.
Yeah. Do you think we're talking about mental health, do you think you've healed as time's gone on, or there's still some questions to be asked, or do you feel that you've healed now, you've come through so many things that have happened? Do you feel that you've healed, particularly the thing to do with your dad? Do you think that you've got all the answers and you'd be able to kind of get on with your life and enjoy life?
Exponentially. I mean, yes. It just, because I've got the maturity and the experience to understand. Now I know what my father's issue was.
Yeah.
I know what my mother's issues were and her challenges and why she was limited as to what she could pour into me.
Yeah.
My brother, who's 13 years older, and why he's where he is in his life now. Oh my goodness, yes indeed. He God laid out my life puzzle, the missing parts he gave me. And once you put them in and you stand up and you look at that puzzle you put together, the answers were always around on the table like pieces of a puzzle.
Yeah.
But I didn't have the ability, the compassion, the discipline to sit back and really, really study.
Yeah.
And after all these years, I have.
Yeah. And quite often, with we don't get these you'd call them secrets or whatever it may be. You don't get told, because we always associate our parents as being immortal.
Oh yeah.
And we see them growing up thinking, and then it's not until something happens and sickness we think, like, wait a minute, she's not immortal, or he's not immortal. They can get sick, because we see them as not, because they're being so tough, we see them as not.
That's right.
Do you see what I mean? And so what happens
yes.
we see them as
yeah.
And it's not until maybe in your 20s or just one moment in time you think, oh, you can get sick, or you are
exactly. Oh my goodness.
And so we then start to, and it's not until we get older, like you say, you start to look back at the puzzle, and we start to realize that. Because we couldn't ask those questions when we were younger. Because
You better not. Man.
Better not.
I mean, listen, you're so spot on. I was in my 30s, Andy, before I realized my mother could be wrong like anybody else.
Yes.
I was so jaded. They walk on water. They had to be right. They told you what to do. You told.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, you didn't think to. At 5 o'clock, Andy, my mother was going to come out of that beauty salon. She was going to sit at the table over to my left. I was sitting here. You barely could get through that little kitchen in that little apartment. But the TV sat on the end of the table. I knew that at 5 o'clock or six, I think it was, might have been 6 o'clock, when she took that break from doing hair to come and sit down for dinner, I'd better act like the walking human remote control and turn that television to Walter Cronkite without her saying a word. Okay?
Yeah.
I better know it. I didn't think. I swore that my mother could look in my brain and see if I had an attitude, and she would knock the. There wasn't.
Yeah.
You know, my granddaughter and grandson were here just this weekend, and I'm still reeling from the fact of my 6-year-old granddaughter. It's just like, oh, I don't want to eat that. I don't want to go there. And my daughter's just, she's running the show. And I'm thinking to myself, I would still be looking for my teeth if I said I didn't want to eat something.
Yeah, yeah.
I still, it's 61, I'd be somewhere, you know. So yeah, you're spot on, Andy. My mother, I forgot what it was, but it was something so blatant that it left me speechless. And I'm thinking, mother, you gotta be crazy. How do you figure that? How do you get that opinion? But it was like, you know,
Yeah,
my mother can be wrong like anybody else.
Yeah, yeah. It's about growing up in different time zones. And sometimes we don't hear the stories of things that they've been, because they don't tell us. They don't tell us the stories. They don't tell us what happened.
Oh.
They don't tell us the ins and outs, because maybe it's protection, or maybe it's something, you know. I'm hearing this a lot, particularly with black people. We keep
everything's a secret.
Keep things a secret, and maybe some of it is down to things that have gone off in their life. I remember in England where, you know, my stepdad or whatever you'd call him now is, and he came over. And my mum, and they used to have things like on the door, you know, no blacks, no Irish, and you couldn't get a home to rent, no blacks, no Irish, and they, you know, the racism and all these things that they put up with, and all these other things coming over from Windrush, coming over from Jamaica, and this sort of, and we don't realise until we get older that the things that they go through, and their struggles, and then we realise, oh. That's the reason why he didn't back me in that scene. Or that's the reason why she didn't show love, because she was being tough for all of us, and he was doing this. So yeah.
Yeah. I mean, Andy, think, how many people do you know, including yourself? How many friends, parents, have pictures of themselves when they were teenagers?
Yeah.
We don't realize that our parents, we don't even, it's not even talked about. They were just, or thought they were just as slick as we were in sixth grade.
Yeah.
They did some of the... See, nobody wants to picture their grandmother dropping it like it's hot.
Yeah, I know.
They act like grandma was never a kid.
Yeah.
Grandma never did.
Did that.
We could really, really have some great times and laugh hearty if people shared.
Yeah.
Again, the age-old thing.
Yeah.
Share. You'd be surprised what you find.
Yeah. And I think some of it, and I'm going to round this up, I think some of it is, do you think some of it would be that they might have been ashamed, not ashamed, but, you're not going to be able to tell your kid that you did this, this, and this. Do you think some of it would have been, I'm giving you some examples. So let's just say if they cheated or whatever, or they danced with another man or, just whatever it may be. And and it was almost like the shame of it of, that needs to be kept quiet. I'm not going to let them know. I can't let them know.
No question. No question, Andy. Because they would then, that would be a chink in their perceived armor.
Yes, yes.
And that would negatively affect their ability to lead and direct you.
Yeah.
Because...
Yeah.
You forgot, God forbid, you sit back and say, well, Mom, you told me that you did such and such. You got a nerve telling me I can't go to the drive-in with Billy and so on. Well, then, see.
Yeah, yeah. So you become their kryptonite.
That's right. They would compromise their authority, and they, can't do that.
What does life look like for you now? You seem happy. You've gone through so much. What does life look like for you? You've been to Florida, Mickey Mouse, and all that sort of stuff. What's life like for you now,
Andy? Sometimes I don't have enough knees to get down on to give thanks.
Yeah.
Right now, today, I ask God on a regular basis how in the world He would give me a wife like Rhonda, who I don't know if you've ever seen her bio, but that aside from the bio, the person that she is every day is teaching me. She's cutting through this Teflon coating of mine that I thought I had, would I be impenetrable for anybody and anything. Teaching me what love is, what things are, the people that we get to touch. I couldn't have it. The kids left. We got home the other day from Orlando. We came back here, and I got on my motorcycle, and I rode out somewhere. I took a ride to meet a buddy of mine for 20 minutes. And there's an old phrase I used to hear about, if my friends could see me now. Well, I didn't have a lot of friends, so that's not true. But when I look at how good God has made this life, my reward for all of the things, negative, the emotions I couldn't handle and so on, was Him giving me her.
Yeah.
He showed me that I was worthy of goodness. He showed me that all the days when I was lost and I did not know why I felt so disconnected. I was that guy in the military, didn't smoke, didn't drink beer, didn't drink liquor, didn't play cards, I didn't eat crabs, so I was an outcast. I didn't fit in nowhere when I got in the military.
Yeah.
So I didn't have that group of guys. I've always been that, but as the road of life came back together, I sit here now, we're building another house, a new house rather. We're able to get up every day, be healthy, for the most part, do that. If I was any better, I'd have to clone myself, Andy.
Yeah.
Bend any more blessed.
Yeah. And what would you say to anybody out there that may be struggling at this time? We didn't even speak about the pandemic or anything like that, but what would you say to anybody that may be struggling at this time? Because you've been through a lot. People have their own nuances and the thing, but what would you say that to help people that would, that may be struggling at this moment in time?
introvert with things that hurt. Someone in your circle could identify and benefit from the things that tug at your heart negatively.
Yeah.
Have a dialogue. Talk to somebody who's closest to you, or that stranger who just has the compassion, and you'd be surprised that how much we're all alike, because we struggle with something. We struggle with something. And through some things, everybody experiences death. Everybody experiences loss of some sort. My daughter called me today, told me somebody stole her car. She's been back home 2 days.
Yeah.
We all, there's something every day in this world.
Yeah.
But if you got your health and strength, I would tell someone, reach out, talk to somebody. You'd be surprised the response you would get and how people are looking for an opportunity to care.
I'd say thank you for talking. I know it's been you know, thing, but I've wanted to have this thing in, and now you've talked to me about these things. I think there's a common ground there, definitely, with some of the things that you've mentioned. I think one thing you mentioned right at the end was love. You mentioned love right at the end, which is kind of conducive with all everything that you said. It's the love.
Yeah.
One more thing. Has Rhonda ever said to you, FBI, stop FBI? Hands up, FBI.
Well, I mean, now, I'm not supposed to be telling the other part about it, right? This thing. Because, I mean, if I can take my shirt off, I can show you the welts on my back with it. And I put makeup on my wrist where she practices with the handcuffs.
Yeah.
I didn't take it. No. No, you know, I am her. You know, I'd stand on the mountaintop and sing her praises. To see what happens when I introduce her to young ladies who are waitresses or they're working jobs through college, and I show them an example of what you can look like doing whatever you do.
Yeah.
People are always aghast when they find out what she does. And she won't say anything. She's quite humble.
Yeah.
She goes about her way, and she blends in to the paint if you let her.
And I'd say thank you for coming on. And she's actually on the, you know, when I've spoken to her, she's actually spoke highly of you as well. So that's the reason why she wanted to come on. But yeah, so I'd like to speak to you again about certain other aspects of it, and you know, things. So I'd like to say thank you for coming on and chatting, and it's been nice and enlightening.
Oh, Andy, it's my pleasure. Kind of shocking. You know, anybody want to talk to me? I've never done anything like this. And I didn't know, she told me it was just going to be audio. I didn't know it was going to be video.
No, I'd have put on a better shirt. No, it's not even, it's only video because me and you are talking. I'm not recording it in video. I'm just recording it in audio.
Gotcha. So, yeah. No worries.
That was Men Are Nuts. Speak to you soon.